This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
I'm Stuart Varney.
I'm Harris Faulkner.
I'm Brian Kilmeade, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Monday, March 4th, 2024, I'm Mike Emanuel. Change is coming to the top leadership post for Senate Republicans. Mitch McConnell says he will not serve as leader in a new Congress next year. There are reports former President Trump favors Montana Senator Steve Daines to be the next leader. But one key senator says Daines already has a critical job leading the Senate GOP campaign arm.
Steve Daines has a really important job right now that I think is the most important thing we need to focus on. And that's to actually win the Senate back, because I want the next Republican leader be the majority leader.
I'm Dave Anthony. 131 years ago today, America's 24th president was sworn in. The only one to do what Donald Trump's attempting. Elected again after being defeated.
Grover Cleveland believed in character, and he was a straight shooter. He was a reformer. He took on the machine and corruption. He told you where he stood and stood there.
And I'm former U.S. Senator Scott Brown. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
There is an ongoing debate in Washington over funding for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. Republicans like Florida Senator Marco Rubio say that's important, but there are more pressing concerns.
I believe that we should help Ukraine, but only after we help America through our border, in the same way as Democrats are saying we won't help Israel unless you help Ukraine, and because they're holding Israel as leverage and hostage over Ukraine.
The other big news in the Senate is the announcement that GOP leader Mitch McConnell will not seek to be leader in a new Congress next year. McConnell's a Reagan Republican, while many of the newer GOP senators are more Trump Republicans, like Ohio Senator J.D. Vance.
You can't have a Senate Republican leader who seems to ooze hatred and dismay for the very people who vote most of the Republican elected leaders.
Florida Republican Congressman Byron Donalds laid out the views of many MAGA Republicans.
Let me tell you the truth. People who are MAGA Republicans, they just want the country to follow the law. They want the country to follow the Constitution. They want our leaders to put America first, not last.
In terms of the next Senate Republican leader, there are three Johns and perhaps several others likely to seek the top job. John Barrasso of Wyoming, John Cornyn of Texas, John Thune of South Dakota. It will be a big change after Mitch McConnell has led the conference since 2007, the longest-serving Senate party leader in U.S. history.
Well, look, he's a historic figure, the longest-serving Republican leader in U.S. history. You know, I was honored to be part of the Republican Senate class of 2014. You might remember, Mike, we were the ones who, big class, a bunch of us beat Democrat incumbents to get rid of Harry Reid, boot Harry Reid as majority leader, and put Mitch McConnell in.
Senator Dan Sullivan is an Alaska Republican.
I think he's got a strong legacy of accomplishment, particularly when we retook the Senate and made him leader, and when the Trump administration got elected on some very important, traditional, critical Republican priorities, rebuilding our military and readiness after the disastrous Obama years of crushing readiness, 25% cuts to our Department of Defense, second term of Obama. Unleashing American energy, which the Democrats always go against, less government and more freedom, getting rid of regs, lowering taxes, which really supercharged our economy, and a generational shift on federal courts in terms of principled textualist judges, conservative judges, particularly on the Ninth Circuit, which really, really matters to me, being Alaska senator. And of course, on the U.S. Supreme Court with three Supreme Court justices, one third of the court done under Leader McConnell's leadership, working closely with the Trump administration. And then finally, this one I think is also important, two others. You know, he protected the institution of the Senate You might remember Schumer had this ill-conceived power grab a couple years ago to get rid of the legislative filibuster based on this bogus charge that, you know, Republicans supported Jim Crow 2.0. You know, that would have made the Senate just like the House. McConnell helped rally not only Republicans, but Democrats against that, which would have, in my view, been, you know, a really bad development for the institution of the United States Senate. And then, you know, he has been a strong proponent of the Reagan approach to foreign policy, peace through strength, in resisting calls for America's retreat in the world.
You know, I've talked to some liberals in recent days since the news broke, and, you know, they don't agree with McConnell on issues, but they seem to respect the way that he led his conference and the way he utilized his power to get important things done, such as those three Supreme Court justices. What about that?
Absolutely critical. You know, and to President Trump's credit, they instituted a very serious approach to selecting judges, conservative, federalist oriented, textualist, believed in the separation of powers. That was key to have those kind of nominees put forward to the Senate. But, you know, McConnell made some very important leadership decisions as it related to filling the seat or not filling the seat of Justice Scalia when President Obama was president, of getting not only Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, but Amy Coney Barrett through during some challenging times. And look, that is a generational achievement that, in my view, will positively impact the country for decades.
Let's talk about the next possible GOP leader. Three guys named John are expected to be potentially in the mix: Barrasso, Cornyn, and Thune. There's a report that former President Trump is suggesting Steve Daines from Montana potentially run. One would imagine that Rick Scott from Florida would want to run after he challenged McConnell the last time. Do you have thoughts on some of these guys and some perhaps women in the Republican conference who may seek leadership? And do you have a favorite?
Well, look, every one of those ones you mentioned are good friends of mine. And I think it's great that we got so many excellent Republican senators who are either throwing their hat in the ring or are considering throwing their hat in the ring. It's healthy. And now is the time to have a good debate on their priorities. Certainly, I'm going to let them know what my priorities are. But I will tell you this. You mentioned Steve Daines. Steve Daines has a really important job right now that I think is the most important thing we need to focus on. And that's to actually win the Senate back, because I want the next Republican leader to be the majority leader in the Senate.
Sure.
And that is really the area that I think we should all be focused on, because we got a good opportunity to do it. And that should be the priority right now. We're going to have plenty of time to have a good discussion with all these excellent senators you just mentioned. But I think what unifies us, certainly every single one of us, is working hard to show Chuck Schumer the door and get a Republican majority leader back in the Senate.
You sit on the Armed Services Committee. As I travel around, I've had some people talk to me and say, why does Ukraine matter to the United States? And my thought is the commander in chief should probably make a speech to the nation reiterating why Ukraine is important to the United States. But for those type of questions and funding going forward for the Ukraine war, make the case for why we should be strong supporters of Ukraine as it fights Vladimir Putin and Russia.
Well, let me just first make the case on the supplemental that we just voted on. Now, it's not a perfect bill, and but I supported it, and it's a national security supplemental. And I really think that the issue here is you have to look at where we are in the world right now. The reasons I voted for this were generally three main reasons. One is that we are in a very dangerous world right now. What I refer to as the new era of authoritarian aggression, led by the dictators, Xi Jinping, Putin, all the terrorist leaders in Iran, and Kim Jong-un. They're working together very closely. If you read the intel and on Armed Services Committee hearings, you can see that. Number two is the Biden administration hasn't taken national security issues seriously in my view, at all. 3 years in a row, they cut defense spending. They focus on issues that have nothing to do with lethality and readiness. This year's Biden budget shrinks the Army, shrinks the Navy, shrinks the Marine Corps. That is not the message you want to send to Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping. And thirdly, Mike, our ability to develop and build weapons to protect ourselves. I'm not talking Ukraine or Israel. I'm talking to protect America has dramatically atrophied. That is a fact. Almost 40% of our attack sub-fleet is in maintenance right now. That's the weapon the Chinese fear the most. So what this bill actually does is almost 60% of this bill goes directly into our ability, the defense industrial base of America, to produce weapons, everything from submarines to 155 millimeter ammo. And that's why I'm supporting it. It shouldn't be called the Ukraine aid bill. It should be called the Enhancing America's Industrial Base to Defend Ourselves bill. And I think that's the key. Now, will some of that be used to get critical weapon systems to allies who are facing existential threats like Taiwan, like Israel, like Ukraine? Yes. Mm-hmm. But primarily, this is a bill about our capacity build weapons and produce ammo to defend ourselves. And I think that should be a unifying message for Republicans. And I hope it is. And then finally, you know, look, it's a really dangerous world. There's no doubt that the weakness shown by the Biden administration in its botched Afghanistan withdrawal was led to emboldening Putin to undertake his brutal invasion of Ukraine. But I think it's strongly in our national security interest, A, to not let Putin roll over on Ukraine, because then he's going to be facing NATO allies of ours, the right. Baltics, Poland, Moldova. And as history shows, dictators on the march, their appetite grows after each meal. And then finally, it's this issue of the broader national security context. If Putin rolls over on Ukraine, watch what's going to happen in the Indo-Pacific region. Watch what's going to happen with regard to Taiwan. And this is where, you know, some of my colleagues in the Congress are saying, well, we can let Putin have his way with Ukraine, but we're going to be really strong with regard to China and the Taiwan Strait. My response to that is, like, deterrence is not divisible. American credibility is not divisible. How do we know this? Because in the aftermath of the botched withdrawal of Afghanistan, many of us, myself included, predicted that the authoritarians of the world would move on other countries because they saw so much weakness from the Biden administration. And guess what? That is exactly what happened. So these are all the reasons, the long answer, but it's an important issue. Mm-hmm. And I do think that even some of the Republicans who didn't vote for the National Security Supplemental in the U.S. Senate, they weren't driven by saying, hey, I don't want to help Ukraine. They were driven more by saying, look, Biden is so fundamentally screwed up the border, so fundamentally screwed up the execution of this Ukraine war because every major weapon system he delays. And that was what's driving a lot of that. And I respect those positions. But when it comes to building our own weapon systems to protect us, which is dramatically atrophied in large part because of Biden, we need to take that seriously. And that's why I support it. It's not a perfect bill. The House can make it better. I had an amendment that would have removed all what they call direct budget support. So that's the money that goes to Ukraine, just in terms of helping their government keep running. My view is America should be providing Ukraine lethal weapons, energy, which now Biden is not, to our allies, which he looks like he's starting to delay. Right. Intel in, you know, operations, but not direct budget support. The House bill could make this national security supplemental better, and I hope they move on this soon.
Senator Dan Sullivan of the great state of Alaska, grateful for your time, sir. Safe travels. Have a great week.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud. Or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda. Whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
I'm Benjamin Hall, Fox News correspondent and New York Times bestselling author. Join me for my brand new podcast, Searching for Heroes. Make sure you subscribe to this series wherever you download podcasts and leave a rating and review.
This is former U.S. Senator Scott Brown with your Fox News commentary coming up.
We appear to be on a collision course for a rematch in November.
Trump is now promising a full-scale campaign of revenge and retribution, his words.
So President Biden says it's too dangerous to elect former President Trump again.
This is a Biden invasion over the past 3 years. I call him Crooked Joe because he's crooked. He's a terrible president.
Trump was our 45th president and is trying to become number 47. Only one other president has ever returned to the White House. On this day, in 1893, Grover Cleveland took office for a second time. Now, back then, March 4th was always Inauguration Day. And Cleveland, who was our 22nd president, became our 24th.
Well, he's not remembered for much, which is unusual because he actually was a pretty effective president on a limited number of goals.
Karl Rove is a Fox News contributor, former senior advisor to President George W. Bush, former deputy White House chief of staff. He wrote a book about William McKinley's election in 1896, which was after Grover Cleveland's second term.
He was chosen by the Democrats in 1884, not because he was the favorite of the party insiders, but because he was a reform-minded governor of the state of New York. He'd been the mayor of Buffalo. He had taken on public corruption in the form of graft and the machine, and he had beaten the political machine in Buffalo and had saved the taxpayers lots of money and used that to vault into the governorship of New York, which was a battleground state. In the Gilded Age, New York, Ohio, and Indiana were the key big battleground states, and the biggest of them all was New York. So the Democrats chose him because he was the Democratic governor of the state with the hope that he would somehow break the 20-some-odd years since the election of Abraham Lincoln in 1860 and put the Democrats back in the White House, and he did.
Now, in 1884, Cleveland beat Republican James Blaine. Now, there was a lot of talk about Blaine being corrupt. The New York World at the time wrote, there are four reasons to support Grover Cleveland. He's an honest man. He's an honest man. He's an honest man. He is an honest man. He was also big on gold standard, and he wanted to bring tariffs down.
The Democratic Party was the party of free trade. They said the working man is the person who pays the protective tariffs through higher prices for everything from his coffee to his sugar. But yes, he was scrupulously honest. And Blaine was suspect for dealing in railroad stock. In fact, he was taunted by the Democrats as James G. Blaine, the monumental liar from the state of Maine, because he had been held to be lying about a series of incriminating letters that showed that he was not only getting stock from the railroad companies for himself, but was using it to grease the skids with other members of the Senate and the House.
Now we fast forward. In 1888, President Cleveland was challenged by a different Republican, Benjamin Harrison, whose grandfather was our ninth president, William Henry Harrison. Benjamin was from Ohio and famously made front porch speeches outside his home. Back in those days, it was not common for a presidential candidate to go out and campaign across the country for himself like now. That was considered unseemly. So President Cleveland didn't do any of that. And in the end, Harrison defeated him, getting more electoral votes, even though Cleveland won the popular vote. 4 years later, Democrats nominated Cleveland again, and he easily defeated Harrison in their 1892 rematch.
So Republicans were the big spenders in large measure because they had to pay out lots of pensions for Union war veterans. Cleveland defeated Harrison largely on the basis of the Republican Congress had passed a $1 billion budget. The first time the U.S. government had a $1 billion budget, it was explained by the Speaker of the House, Thomas Brackett Reed of Maine. He said, we passed a $1 billion budget because we're a $1 billion country. But by 1890 in the congressional elections, the Republicans were nearly wiped out. And by 1892, the country was ready to return Cleveland. But like a lot of people who've held the White House, his second term was deeply unpleasant. He became enormously unpopular. He defended the gold standard as the country fell into an economic collapse in 1892. Many Democrats called for a bimetallic policy, that is to say, to monetize silver so that silver could be turned into coinage along with gold. And Cleveland was a gold man. He believed that a silver dollar was an inflationary currency that would reduce the purchasing power of working people. And so he vetoed every measure that the Democratic legislature, the Congress, sent him on this. So by the time the 1896 election came around, even though we didn't have a provision in place that you couldn't have a third term, the Democratic Party splits apart. A silver movement grows up, driven primarily by several Southern senators, and they literally take control of the Democratic Party, and state after state Democratic convention passes resolutions condemning Grover Cleveland, the Democratic president.
You know, it's interesting because as he does that and bucks his own Democrat-controlled Congress, he was like his successor in a way. I mean, McKinley came in, he was elected in 1896, beat a free silver candidate, William Jennings Bryan. McKinley also was a gold standard guy. Now, they differed on the tariff, but Cleveland was like him in that way.
Actually, McKinley didn't want to have the election to be about the gold standard because he had been sort of flirting earlier in his career with some half measures on silver. And so he was forced into this because the issue became the other side was for silver. He was mildly for gold. And it was only when two people, the Democratic mayor of Scranton, Pennsylvania, who had been the former president of the largest labor union in America, and a brash young New Yorker who had come in third in the race for the New York mayoral post, both of these two men began to talk about the gold issue in a way that appealed to working people. One of them, the New Yorker, a young man named Theodore Roosevelt, would show up at rallies with two loaves of bread, a complete loaf. He said, this is what a gold dollar will allow the working man to buy his family. And then a half a loaf. This is what a silver dollar will be able to buy. The working man will be able to buy only half a loaf of bread to feed his family. And so they began to talk about the impact on wages that a silver currency would have. And that's what changed the tone of the election and its direction.
And obviously, Roosevelt, 4 years later, became McKinley's running mate and became president when McKinley was assassinated. I want to go back to Grover Cleveland. Now, Cleveland is known for a few other things. Obviously, his two terms as president that were not consecutive. He's the only president to ever be married in the White House.
He'd been a lifelong bachelor, or a longtime bachelor, who admitted to an affair that had created a child. But he marries a much younger woman, and it is the social event of the quarter century. I mean, the entire nation is focused on, at this point, still somewhat popular president marrying the vivacious young woman, and it is the talk of the country.
Frances Folsom, she's the youngest first lady we've ever had. She was only 21. He was 49 when they got married.
Yeah, she was the daughter of one of his closest friends. And he had known her since she was born and was very close to her parents. And of course, this was sort of scandalous. But on the other hand, people had a certain admiration for the he was a little bit overweight, a big man. And she was tiny and pretty and vivacious, and she captivated the country.
Another thing that people may not know, one of his children, Ruth Cleveland, she was born in 1891 in between his two terms as president. She died in 1904 when she was 12 years old. A candy bar comes out about 100 years ago that we know now as the Baby Ruth bar.
Right.
The candy company claims they named the candy for Ruth Cleveland, who had died like 15, 20 years earlier. You believe that, or maybe it's more about the baseball player?
I think it's more about the baseball player, but pick your story, the bambino or the attractive young woman. Take your choice.
Now, we, of course, are in 2024 watching a possible presidential return to office like Cleveland. Donald Trump wants to be president 47. He was our 45th president. Any similarities at all between these two men?
Well, no, one is a brash entrepreneur and the other one was Grover Cleveland believed in character and he was a straight shooter. He was a reformer. He took on the machine and corruption. He told you where he stood and stood there. He was not a particularly effective speaker, but his performance in office as mayor and as governor and then as president caused people to understand and respect his uprightness and his firmness and his convictions. You know, this is only the second time that a former president is running to try and beat the guy who beat him. But we've had two other former presidents try and run for a second term, albeit not, 4 years later. Martin Van Buren is defeated for re-election in 1840. And in 1848, he runs again, though he's not at this point the candidate of the party that he founded. He's considered the founder of the modern Democratic Party machine. But in 1848, he runs for president as a third party candidate on the Free Soil ticket and loses. And Millard Fillmore in 1856, who had been the vice president for Zachary Taylor, who died in office, and Fillmore had succeeded to the post, he runs 8 years later in 1856 as the candidate of the American Party, the Know-Nothings, the anti-immigrant party.
Didn't Teddy Roosevelt run again, 1912?
Yeah, and he did run again. You're right. I'm sorry, I left him out, but you're absolutely right. And of course, gets 88 electoral votes, while the incumbent Republican president, Howard Taft, gets eight. William Howard Taft gets eight electoral votes, and 435 go to Woodrow Wilson, who becomes the first Democrat president after Grover Cleveland and is the last one until for FDR in 1932.
Back to 2024, Super Tuesday is tomorrow, March 5th. Is this the day former President Trump can essentially lock it up, do you think?
Well, his campaign says that he will have a majority of the delegates by the end of March, and I think that's right. He's got some work to do to unite the party, and the question is how good a job is he going to be at that? It's one thing to say, I'm turning my attention to the general election. It's another thing to say, I'm turning my attention to the general election, and I'm healing and uniting the Republican Party.
But if Nikki Haley goes 0-16 on Super Tuesday, then what?
Well, she's probably likely to do that, but on the other hand, think about this. People are voting for her not because they think she's going to win, but because they want her to win. This is not Game of Thrones. This is a democracy, and he's got to take steps to unite the party as previous contenders have done and faced with tough contests. And having been through this process in 2000 with George W. Bush having beaten John McCain, I can tell you it's not easy, but it's absolutely critical to winning the general election.
Karl Rove, Fox News contributor, former senior advisor to President George W. Bush, and a former deputy chief of staff in the White House. Great to talk to you. Thanks for bringing us back 131 years. We appreciate it.
You bet. Thanks for the trip back in the time capsule.
Here's a look at the week ahead.
Tuesday, over a dozen states will be voting in their primaries, also known as Super Tuesday. It's when most of the delegates are up for grabs. Overwhelming victories for both President Biden and former President Trump could see their nominations all but secure. Also Tuesday, trial begins for James Crumbly. His son opened fire at Oxford High School in Michigan in 2021, killing four, injuring seven. Crumbly and his wife Jennifer were charged with involuntary manslaughter for not doing enough to prevent the killings. Jennifer was found guilty in all four counts last month. Thursday, President Biden will head to Capitol Hill to give his third State of the Union address, fulfilling a constitutional mandate. Alabama Senator Katie Britt will be giving the Republican response. Friday marks the 10th anniversary of the disappearance of MH370. The Malaysian Airlines flight took off from Kuala Lumpur, headed to Beijing with nearly 240 people on board. The search for the missing plane became the most expensive in the history of aviation. And that's a look at your week ahead. I'm Tom Graham, Fox News.
This episode is brought to you by Etsy. Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Now until May 12th, get up to 30% off personalized jewelry, style, decor, and so many other items mom will love. And if you want her to know you put a ton of thought into her present, use Gift Mode. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting so you can easily find well-crafted, original, and affordable pieces from small shops. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about mom, and Gift Mode instantly gives you curated ideas based on hundreds of personas. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
Tuesday, Fox News Radio has complete coverage of Super Tuesday. Jared Halpern and Jessica Rosenthal bring you the results as they happen. Just click listen on the Fox News app starting at 9 p.m. Eastern to hear it all. It's Democracy 24 on Fox News Radio. Rate and review the Fox News Rundown on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
It's time for your Fox News commentary.
Scott Brown.
What's on your mind?
More than a year after their spy balloon nearly launched an international incident, China has hit a rough patch. Slowing growth, an aging workforce, and the aftershocks of their zero COVID policies have fueled their economic woes, with foreign businesses' direct investment falling to a 30-year low. Yet certain inexplicable decisions from the White House represent a lifeline to a country who has made no secret of its desire to supplant the United States as the world economic superpower by 2035. And here are three of them. First, President Joe Biden used Super Bowl Sunday to debut his campaign on TikTok. In doing so, he implicitly defied the orders of 34 governors, including many Democrats, who have explicitly banned the app on government devices. At issue are two competing interests, political versus security. On the former, Biden is desperate to win over young voters, normally a reliable Democratic voting bloc, but where recent polls show him behind former President Donald Trump by a considerable margin. Yet there are major concerns about the privacy and data security on TikTok. Not even a year has passed since TikTok CEO faced withering bipartisan criticism from the House Committee on Energy and Commerce. His answers failed to persuade lawmakers or the general public, but were apparently enough for the Biden campaign. Second, as Beijing touts its approval of more than 40 AI models for public use in the last 6 months, the Biden administration wages war on American tech firms. Lina Khan, chair of the Federal Trade Commission, rose to prominence on the political left as an avowed critic of free enterprise. And as expected, she has aggressively targeted America's leading tech companies, including landmark antitrust lawsuit against Amazon. In a recent inquiry involving compulsory orders to five tech companies regarding their investments in AI. But she has also broadened her ideological attacks on private businesses to include grocery stores and even sandwich shops. When American companies are getting sandbagged by their own government as their Chinese counterparts gobble up market share, it's a sign of upside-down priorities. Finally, as Biden continues to dither on taking executive action on immigration, a jarring report from 60 Minutes found that Chinese migrants are the fastest growing group crossing the southern border. According to the U.S. Customs and Border Protection, 37,000 Chinese citizens were apprehended crossing illegally into our country last year. That's a 50% increase from 2 years earlier. At the same time, FBI Director Christopher Wray is sounding the alarm about China's efforts planting offensive malware inside U.S. critical infrastructure networks, describing the issue as, quote, a scale greater than we'd seen before, end quote. Wray labeled the actions a defining national security threat and laying the groundwork to attack whenever Beijing decides the time is right. During his successful campaign to pass a bipartisan infrastructure bill in 2021, Biden used that to warn that China was, quote, going to eat our lunch, end quote. It made for a snappy soundbite then, but would be better served guiding his administration's policy decisions right now. This is former U.S. Senator and former U.S. Ambassador to New Zealand and Samoa, Scott Brown.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. And now, stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com.
I'm Guy Benson. Join me weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and guests. Listen live on the Fox News app or get the free podcast at GuyBensonShow.com.